Welcome, everybody, to episode number 110 of Underserved. Joining me in studio today is Rob Larson, a software development manager in the Boston area. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
Rob, thank you so much for joining us today on Underserved.
Andrew, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. So way back when, like, how did you kind of first become interested in technology?
I started programming in middle school and in high school, BASIC and Pascal, and that was over a couple of years. So that laid a decent foundation. I didn't end up continuing with that, even though I really liked it. Actually ended up going to school for acting, which was a lot of fun, but wasn't technology for sure.
You went to Emerson?
I went to Emerson, yes.
Okay. Any particularly instructive or formative folks you met there?
Did study with a woman, Kristen Linklater, who, when she passed away a couple years ago, you know, she's one of those people that has like a half a page in the New York Times for her obituary. Very famous and very influential acting teacher. She wrote a book called Freeing the Natural Voice, which is like used as a textbook in certain voice instruction. So being able to project in a big hall, she has all of these really interesting ideas about that, as well as acting.
Now, you actually wrote a play that was produced?
Yes. So I was at Emerson for a year, and the only thing that I really enjoyed at Emerson was Kristen Linklater's class. The rest of it was a waste of time and money. I had the opportunity with a couple of friends of mine. Someone reached out to my friend Yaakov and said, oh, I have this play idea. Can you write it? Because he was a filmmaker and had done some theater. And he enlisted me and two other friends to complete this play. So we sat in my friend's attic around a round table over summer and fall. I was assistant director. I acted in like three or four like bit roles just to fill out the cast. It was a lot of fun.
Now, at the same time, you're starting to dabble in technology. It's late 90s and getting involved in at least knowing Microsoft Word and some of the basics.
Yeah. So there was a period where I was solely trying to work as a writer and as an artist, do some art. Doesn't matter how good you are, it just, you have to work at it. You have to knock on doors. You have to get a break or two, right? So I needed to make money. And one of the things that I had the ability to do as a writer was like operate Microsoft Word. There was a market for people who could just come in and kind of do complicated Microsoft Word formatting. And so I was doing that as a temp, making a reasonable amount of money, did a long gig at one of the many hospitals in the area doing proposals for grants. And so the doctor would come in and he'd be all frazzled because he had just done rounds or whatever. And then he'd like give me all these edits and I'd have to do the edits and get them out the door and try and get this $50,000 grant or $100,000 grant or whatever.
But then you also mentioned in passing to the staffing folks, hey, I happen to know HTML. How does that change things?
Yeah, well, I had some credits and it was the kind of the dawn of the web. I wanted to get that stuff out there so that I could point people to it and leverage that. So I took operating a computer that I was doing, which didn't seem like that much of a thing to me, although people were paying me to do it, and this kind of basic programming knowledge that I had from a decade previous. And I figured out how to make a site. Like you said, I mentioned this in passing to one of the staffing people and their eyes just like bugged out of their heads. You know, I'm just there to get my paycheck at the Friday. And it was just like in passing. I was like, oh, hey, can you take this test? And not only did I pass, but they said, oh no, can you start immediately? And that was how I started on the web.
Now, this is in the good old days when like you could actually do a view source and learn something from it.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that we've talked about for years. In addition to doing this stuff, I'm a bit of a web historian because I've seen a lot of it happen and took part in some kind of fun ways that the web developed over the years. That's one of the things that was really important about the development of the early web is that you could just look and see how people had done things. We weren't minimizing code. We weren't minifying code. We weren't obfuscating anything. Yeah, you couldn't necessarily understand what was happening when you hit post, but like everything that happened in the browser was possible. And so you could very quickly just look for an example of what you wanted to do, view source, copy it, hack at it. And if it worked, you learned something. you know, and you were able to publish your own stuff. Because nobody, especially the mid to late 90s, the only people that really knew this stuff were the people writing specifications. It was just the Wild West, you know? No one knew that it was going to end up being this important thing that would help the development of the web.
Now, while starting out on the tech track, you were still writing for a couple magazines?
Yeah, so in 96, I met a guy named Jeff Lawrence at a party in Somerville. And Jeff had this vision of creating kind of like a funky literary magazine. And I pitched immediately. And I just, I can write about martial arts movies, Hong Kong movies. He's like, that's the best. And so he was very excited. And I think our passion for it kind of ignited him to actually step up and do it. And we did. So Shovel ran from 96 as a standalone magazine from 96 to 99. And then Jeff decided that he wanted to turn this into a real thing. This was just a monthly magazine. But he wanted to make it bigger. And he looked and he said, you know what? I want to take on the Boston Phoenix, which was hilarious and scary. And I honestly just didn't think it was the greatest idea in the history of the world because they had a radio station, they had the paper, they were just this like monolith in alternative culture here in Boston. He's like, oh, I can do it. And so we started Boston's Weekly Dig, which became Dig Boston, and had a great run, but my initial job was just to be a cheerleader. And I was doing these like really kind of experimental pieces for Shovel. And I said, this just seems so standard, you know? And eventually he kind of wore me down and I ended up being film editor there for a couple of years.
But you got to meet some pretty cool people.
I did, yeah. So I met Darren Aronofsky, John Waters. I interviewed Donnie Yen. Like at that time, it was at the bottom of his career. He'd had a really good career in the 80s and 90s in Hong Kong and like really wasn't getting a lot of work. And he did this movie where he literally didn't speak. He just came in and did two fight scenes without speaking. He needed a paycheck, apparently. You know, 20 years later, he's in a Star Wars movie. You know, it was a fun time.
Darren Aronofsky, I think that's around the time he did Pi, right?
It was after Pi. It was Requiem for a Dream.
Okay.
So I spent, you know, 45 minutes talking to him about that.
Powerful and disturbing.
Yeah, it was a really hard movie to watch. And it's like one of those movies that I never want to see this again. I told him that. I was like, yeah, it was really beautiful. I'm happy that I saw it. I'm really happy I get to talk to you about it, but probably never going to watch that one again.
I saw the credits for Pi, and a kid that I went to high school with, Nico Tavernisi, who's now like a famous movie photographer, back then was the ant wrangler for all of the little ant scenes they had in there.
Oh my goodness. That's a great credit.
So on the tech side, still doing some work with Advisor Tech?
Yeah. So I ended up hearing about this opportunity. It was at a startup called Advisor Tech. This guy, Tim McCarthy, who had been at Schwab and Fidelity, had this idea to take some of the lessons that he had learned at Schwab and Fidelity and bring it over to Japan. So Japan was opening up the way that they handled retirements. So they had these, like, I don't even understand them. And I worked for a company that was dealing with them. They had these postal savings accounts, which was like the only place you could save for retirement. And they were changing their rules in order to allow for mutual funds or mutual fund-like products. And the thing that Fidelity and Schwab had understood and had been very successful with was growing a network of independent financial advisors here in the United States who would then sell their product to people who were just looking for retirement information and couldn't figure it out themselves. So we were looking to replicate that plan in Japan.
The only problem is Japan's economy is not doing too well.
Well, see, this is, you know, it's a very funny and very tough story for Japan. You see these green shoots and you think like, oh, Japan is finally turning the corner. And this happens like every 5 years. They've had a good run recently, but for the previous 30 plus years, they had these false starts after false starts after false starts. And that was one of them. We walked into the middle of one of their false starts.
And I mean, this is right around the time of like the dot-com crash and 9/11. What's it like at the company after that?
Yeah. So the anecdote I always tell is that we raised the second highest amount of money in March of 2000. And we were behind a company called Cosmo.com, which was genius in a way, but it was just ahead of its time. Every, you know, Instacart, all of these delivery companies, that's what Cosmo was doing, except they didn't understand that you could do this gig thing. They didn't have all of the details worked out, but that was what they did. If you wanted a candy bar, you would just pay and get a candy bar and someone would show up at your house in 20 minutes. So they raised, I think, $125 million and we raised $95 million. And then the dot-com crash happened. And then 9/11 happened and that, you know, really, that was the the other shoe dropping for us. And so, you know, that sunk financial markets in a big way. Japan's green shoots didn't end up being green shoots. We ended up pivoting to Germany. But we had enough money, and it was a decent set of ideas, a good set of technology, a good team. We just held on for as long as we could. But I feel especially fortunate now because it enabled me to bridge from that dot-com boom to this place in technology where everything that I had learned and had been working on was suddenly like very important. And that hasn't changed. So that was like 18 years ago, and it hasn't changed since. So that buffer that we had was hugely important to me.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Maris Consulting Group, embracing the power of people in technology. For more information, visit mariscg.com. That's MARISCG.com.
You did some interesting freelance work around that time for the Museum of Science Boston in particular.
Yeah, so that's an example of how I was able to leverage this set of tools that I had built up. Elistapart came out with their, you know, oh, we're going to do, you know, pure CSS layouts. And they solved all of these problems. And I was one of the people that was like really excited to take this information in and start to play around with it. I got laid off at Advisor Tech finally. They kept me on until they basically
couldn't.
It ended up that it was just like a sysadmin and then like three other people. And it was basically just keeping the lights on. And then we ended up selling all the assets. So, but I was one of the last people to be let go. And by that time, things had started to open up again with technology. So I was able to just jump in and, you know, go to some staffing firm, and they were really happy to see me again. And the Museum of Science is looking to redo their site, which was like thousands of pages, to be a pure CSS layout. We actually had to call it table list because we used HTML tables to lay out everything in the early 2000s. But it was a pure CSS layout, and it was leveraging all that stuff from Elistapart articles and you know some of the work that they had done. But it was one of the largest top 50 site in America at the time. And it was certainly one of the biggest sites that was transitioned to fully CSS layouts at the time. Yeah, really exciting opportunity to be able to put some of those ideas that had been playing around in my personal sites and all of these things to actually put it into a very important site to the city of Boston. It's a, you know, major kind of cultural science institution here in the city. So it was very exciting for me.
So you follow that on just as Ajax gets invented.
Yes.
You get pulled into RaiseLabs to do an interesting project for one of their customers. What was that about?
Yeah. So there's two stories here where I needed health insurance. And so I got to get a job. You know, this freelancing is great, but I saw this ad for RaiseLabs. It was RaiseLabs was just one guy at the time, Greg Rays, and he was looking for a second person. And it was, he's kind of focused on web consulting. So I was like, oh, okay, this is great. And I went in and we did a few different projects. But the big thing that I got out of that was Ajax had, the term had been coined, right? This is what we're calling this pattern. But the pattern had been developing over the last couple of years. And so there was actually a reasonable body of knowledge about it. And this article just like was like a bolt from the blue that just like crystallized everybody's ideas about what web development could be and what standards-based web development could be. And so people started to have, oh, you know, we could do this on the web and we could do this on the web. And this company had this idea of taking any location data like they could get from RFID or Wi-Fi or anything that could send a signal that they could read and triangulate, like figure out location data. So we're going to put these chips on, like in a hospital, you need like a defibrillator or whatever. It's a very important piece of equipment. They move around. They're on a cart. And so you could put one of these chips on it, and then you could go to your local desktop and pull up this web page that would tell you where it was. And you would take, you know, location data, you would take a map of the floor that you were on, and then we could take, you know, X and Y coordinates on that 2D map and be like, oh, it's in room 9, go run, get it. And we could actually do that with doctors. It's like, where's the heart surgeon? Oh, we need him right now. Just sew up this guy, this gunshot wound victim. Oh my God. And they're running down the hall and they know where he is. And so it was a great idea. But, hey, can you build this interface for us? And so it was two parts. Like I look back and I understand how I did it because it's just what we did. But with today's React or Angular or, you know, Vue or any of these, I could do a working demo of this in like 2 days. And it took us, you know, 6 weeks to do just a working demo because we had to do everything. It was like, it's like, you know, managing all of those things that you kind of get for free just by like NPM install, MPX create React app, and you just like have all of this running. It was right before jQuery became a thing. So our options were like YUI and prototype, which again, are like kind of ancient history. Yahoo was Yahoo's user interface library, and prototype was, we called it Blototype at the time, was just this gigantic, really actually elegant in some ways, JavaScript library that was kind of popular at the time, but a lot of people were wary of it because it's 300K, which at the time was just like five times bigger than your page should be.
The sumo wrestler of JavaScript libraries. Yes.
It was powerful and just gigantic and ate a lot of rice. And so we're like, I'm not using that. And so we ended up having to do a lot of it ourselves, you know, just the whole thing. And it's taught me so much. And we're solving problems. I mean, one of the people that had done this previously was like Office Online, like XML HTTP request was a Microsoft extension to the technology world. It was in Internet Explorer first, and they leveraged it to do Outlook on the web. And so they had certainly seen some of the things that we were seeing, but we would run into stuff like, oh yeah, we're in a warehouse, so we're tracking everything in the warehouse. So we have, you know, 10,000 objects, especially at the time, you just can't put 10,000 objects into the DOM and track them and render them in real time. And so things started to just blow up. And so, you know, it's like one of the nice to haves, which was like collapsing many points into a single point with just like a number on it. It's like, oh, if you have like 100 here, just, and then you would click in and zoom in. It was an emergency to implement that. And then also like just stupid stuff that just now we would take for granted, or the plumbing of React or Angular or whatever would just take care of. We actually saw it like happen. You know, why is this page grinding to a halt? It's like, well, let me tell you.
After finishing this project up, you move further into the agency world at Cramer?
Yeah, so I went to Cramer. Cramer was a much more interesting opportunity for me, and it seemed like a really nice environment. This guy, Red Martin, so played hockey for BC, he's in the BC Hall of Fame for hockey, played the Olympics, and his whole family worked there. And they had bought just like this video production company in the 80s. And had turned it into this full service marketing agency. And then as agencies did, they said, well, let's see if we can do some of this web stuff. Because they were doing events, and as an adjunct to that, they were like, oh, well, we can do the event website. And so they had really, over the last couple of years, had really built up that business and needed more technical expertise because they were being asked to do more complicated stuff. And so I looked at it and I was like, it's a nice kind of family run business. It's 20 minutes from my house. They serve lunch every day. This is great. And so I went there. Yeah, I just went fully into the agency existence.
Now, you may or may not have been the first, but you were one of the first people way back when to get a video to play in the background of a web page.
In 2007, we were working for E3, you know, the big technology expo. That was one of their sites that they had done before I got there. And they were doing another site, E4All. And one of the ideas that we had for the site was to put a video into the background. Now, technically at that point, you couldn't lay anything on top of a Flash movie because it was actually being ported outside of the browser to the OS. So it was actually a separate window that was being rendered into the page. So you couldn't put HTML on top of it. It was actually just like some ActiveX or whatever control.
Could you iframe it?
No, you could not put anything on top of a Flash. Huh. Was on top of the stack no matter what you did. Huh. And so what I had to do was cut the movie into two separate movies and then with JavaScript adjust the quote background, which was actually two divs on each side of the main div, you know, as the screen moved. I wrote it up. I wrote a blog post about it and somebody said, oh yeah, the PlayStation UK did something similar. And I didn't realize, because it was kind of embarrassing. It was such a stupid idea at the time. I was like, this is so bloated. No one is ever going to want to see this.
Fast forward to every web page in 2023.
Well, I could have researched it at the time. Like, am I the first person to do this? And if you look at the blog post, I actually say, like, I don't know, I might be the first person to do this, but like, I'm sorry. I look back on that and I'm like, that's everywhere now.
Well, we all have some odd legacies. We'll talk about one in your next job at Isobar.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's always such a funny story. I interviewed, and it was Molecular, which was locally a very well-known agency. And my first day, I was suddenly working at Isobar, which no one knew, but it was the company that had bought Molecular. And the Boston office of Isobar was no longer going to be called Molecular. But that place was a hive of talent and a hive of just trying crazy fun things. And so we ended up doing a couple of really great projects there. One of them was the Samsung Olympic Genome Project for the 2012 Olympics, which is like that 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon thing, but with Facebook data back when you could hoover up everything. I look back on it, I'm like, wow. And all we were doing with it, you know, it's just like this incredible like vacuuming up of data. And all we were doing with it was trying to figure out like if you and Michael Phelps both liked Taylor Swift or something like that, right? So I had to build this kind of crazy interface for it. It was a Facebook application, which is its own set of challenges because you're inside of another page. So that was one thing. So we had to keep that in mind with the design. But the interface was just bonkers. It was a parallax was a big thing, which is this like illusion of movement in web pages. And so, and that was fine because there were libraries that did this with jQuery era. So it was like, oh yeah, there's 5 jQuery parallax plugins. And so this is fine. I can do that. And they're like, yeah, but we want it to go vertical and not just horizontal. And I was like, I don't even know.
What is vertical parallax?
This doesn't even work, right? Like, well, yeah, but can you just animate it down? The parallax was great. It was easy and it was the skyline of London. And you would, in each, you know, Big Ben or Parliament would be like a menu item and you would click on that. And then that visualization, so this was in Canvas, HTML5 Canvas, but we had to do like all of these, you know, polyfills. And it was just like pulling my hair out to make this thing work as broadly as possible. It was a Samsung campaign for the Olympics. It had to work in everything. And I was doing like this bonkers stuff.
Hey, sport. How was school today?
It was okay, Dad. How was work?
Ugh. Actually, I had a rough day. Leading an engineering team is hard. I mean, I have to ship new software, meet deadlines, and tackle new projects while keeping my team focused on the day-to-day. It's hard to keep up.
Jeepers, Dad. Why don't you call Maris? They're the staffing firm with the best technical resources around. They helped Billy's dad. He used to be stressed out like you. He was missing deadlines, his team was overworked, and a bunch of folks left the company because it was too stressful. But then he called Maris. And they put resources to work right away. He hit all his deadlines and freed up his team to do other work. His boss was so happy that Billy's dad got some extra time off.
Time off? Wow. What did he do with that?
He spent it with Billy. Aww.
That's a swell idea, son. I'll call Maris today. Now, you go wash up for supper.
You also met Paul Irish there, right?
I did, yeah. So Paul was, you know, one of the bigger guys locally in open source and front end development. He was working triage for jQuery and doing a couple of other things. He'd done an infinite scrolling plugin for jQuery, and it was everywhere at that point. So if you don't like infinite scrolling, you can blame him. And so I interviewed with him, and I was like, oh, this would be great. I can work with Paul. You know, I did actually get to start my open source kind of life working with him on HTML5 boilerplate. And then like one day I walked in, it's so exciting, Paul, this is great, you know, whatever. And we're working on this stuff and we're doing project work and it's all very exciting. And he walks in, he's like, I'm going to Google. I was like,
of course you are.
Killing me. You know, it was like, what the interesting thing of working with him was that his passion for open source and his ability to kind of get people excited about it. So
this is also the time that you wrote your first book, right?
Yeah. So I had been writing articles for IBM DeveloperWorks and a couple of other outlets. You know, I had all these writing credits for other things, you know, the movies and all that kind of stuff. And I had started writing on my blog. So that the article I wrote about, you know, the web page background was on my blog. And some of them, you know, were like Slashdot. So I got Slashdot and Front Page of Dig and all that kind of stuff. So I had some momentum on that stuff. You know, some of my articles just like would show up in people's inboxes. And this agent for this agency you know, the technology was like, hey, can you write some articles for IBM? I was like, oh, yeah, sure. Pay me money. That's amazing. And so I did several articles for IBM. So they loved me. And that was the short form side, their book side. Yeah, we have this problem. We sold this book to Wiley and the guy disappeared. Like he literally like left the country and was not answering. And I don't know what happened. I mean, that was what I was presented with. It's like, he's missing. Like it's the internet era. You can't email him? Oh, he ghosted you. Like, okay. But they had already paid him in advance and stuff like that. There was already like money sunk into this book and it was half done. And they said, can you finish this? And I said, okay. And they said, told me explicitly, you can't rewrite any of it.
This is all about jQuery?
jQuery, yeah. Okay. It was called Professional jQuery. So he had written the first half and I read through it and I was like, it wouldn't have been the way I would have gone, but whatever, it was fine. You know, when you're writing, especially a book, there's a real benefit in being able to build on the lessons that you had previously taught. So you start with a basic concept, you return to it later, you add more information. And by the time they get to the third chapter, the stuff in the first chapter hopefully has sunk in. I lost the ability to do some of that. So I don't think the book was as good as it could have been because I didn't have that ability to kind of really lead the reader down the path of understanding. It's that, like, I wish I could have written the whole thing. So
now for your next gig, your wife's in a job and someone says, does anyone know anyone, maybe like a thought leader that could help us build a practice? And she raised her hand.
Yeah, it was at Sapient Global Markets. So Sapient, again, one of these like 90s darlings, had done more kind of hardcore consulting work and had also survived the dot-com explosion or implosion or whatever you want to call it, and had started, was one of the Western companies, was like, hey, you know, we can open offices in India. There's all these genius engineers there. They're cheaper than American engineers. This would be great. We can, you know, have some of the work done there. We can still have local representatives selling. And of course, the Infosys and all those companies reversed the process and sent people to the States because it's like, well, we could just do that. But they were one of the first, you know, people to really do that. And so they had managed to survive the 2000s and they bought Nitro, which was a full just marketing agency. And they had Sapient Nitro was just this Coca-Cola and Dunkin' Donuts or whatever. And they would do really great high profile websites and marketing stuff. But they still had a bunch of people that had been around in the 90s, early 2000s. They had a bunch of very heavy engineering talent in financial services and energy. So basically, like, the breakdown is like anything where there's contracts. So you have futures contracts, you have all those things. Energy has a lot of plumbing that's the same with financial services. That business was focused in Sapient Global Markets. And around this time, so this is another one of these inflection points, HTML5 was the big thing. And these big investment banks were like, do you guys do HTML5? We want to get off of this like legacy application and put it on the web because it seems like way cooler.
We do tons of that. We have 20 years of experience in it.
Basically. They had one guy in London and that was it. But they were like, we'll just build a practice. And so that they put the call out and I was ready made for it. I came in and really exciting, built a practice from zero to like 35. I was there for a year. I was just there for a year. But it was like totally functional, very excited to be doing what they were doing. A really passionate group of folks from around the world. So,
but the downside is you're commuting back and forth to one of their biggest clients in New York.
Yeah. So the sale there was to be like when I was hired, it was to be more of a strategic resource, which for the first kind of 6 to 8 months I was, and it was doing all of that. I was like, can you get on the phone with, you know, this like bank from the UK and talk about what we're doing and answer their questions about HTML? Oh, yeah, that's great. Oh, we want you to go to India and speak at a conference. Oh, that's awesome. Wow. Thank you. It just happens, right? It's like, we have a need. Oh, we have this like 5-star target client in New York. Can you go down? Oh, yeah, sure. What do you want me to do? It's like, well, just like show them we know what we're doing. And my boss at the time was actually the tech lead for the front end on that project. And then like his father got sick. And so he just had to go home. He went home to India. And it's like, hey, can you do that now? And I was like, yeah, of course. You know, I want to support him. And so I did. And at the same time, I was doing like sales engineer work with the same company. They had an application that was very slow and it was written in ext.js. And I walked in and, okay, kind of jokingly, but not jokingly, I was like, well, I found your problem. See this? EXTJS. That's your problem. Let me rewrite it. And they're like, no, it's not EXT. I was like, well, okay, fine. I was like jumping. These are both in New York. I was jumping back and forth between the two groups within the same company. One being the tech lead for the front end components of this kind of crazy application that we were building. And the other was doing this kind of sales engineer work where I was like proving to them that I wasn't just being a tech nerd and wanting to use the fancy new technology. It's like, no, there's actually problems with the way that this particular library works in the way that you're trying to make it work. And so I found myself commuting. I would leave on Monday. I would come home on the Acela at like 2 or 3 on Friday. The guy at the bar cart knew me because I would like go down there and I'd get like 2 like nips and like go back to my go back to my chair and then just like read and nod off after a while and then get home and have like dinner at 8. And I just was sick of it. And there was no way, like I realized there was no way that I was ever going to be able to get out of that because it was too big of a client and it was too much money and they liked me. And I was like, I'm stuck doing this. So it was either I commuted every week or I moved to New York. And I was like, this is not what I want to do. Plus I had wanted to do the strategic stuff. I had wanted to be like, you know, building things, not just working on projects. So
luckily you find a gig at Wellington Management. I spent some time there myself.
Yeah. So I was able to just kind of talk to folks after leaving Sapient. I said, hey, you know, I'm looking for a job. And one of the people that I had met through Sapient at Wellington was looking for somebody to do something very similar to what I was doing at Sapient, which is like bring in modern technology, talk about architecture, talk about front-end engineering, and just add some expertise to that. So I did that, went in, brought in Angular 1, and just kind of built out a small practice, not quite as big as the one at Sapient, but did that work for a year. And then they had an internal restructuring. And you know how it goes. It's like, oh yeah, move that guy over there. And then the guy was me. And I walk into a meeting with somebody I just didn't even know who they were. And he probably just looked at me and was like, oh, that's a big line item. I don't need this guy. And so I went into a meeting with him and I just told him, here's all the things that I was paying attention to. Find somebody to pay attention to them. Thank you.
So that's how you left and started Palatino Consulting?
Yes. Again, I wanted more of a challenge. And, you know, people looked at my resume and they said, oh God, you know, you could be just this great individual contributor engineer. And I was like, no, I don't want to. I was just running a team of 30 at Sapient. You know, but it's like I had all these technologies that people were focusing on. And I had this like very strong technical track record, not just a resume, but like you could point to things. I just didn't like the jobs that I was seeing. And I said, well, you know, I'm not going to say no. I'll still talk to recruiters, but I'm just going to hang my own shingle. And so I spun up an LLC and put up a simple website and went on LinkedIn and was like, hey, I'm doing my own thing. Let me know if you need any help. And all within my just immediate network, I lined up work like almost immediately.
Folks that have been in the tech industry for a while are familiar with the O'Reilly series of technical books.
Yes.
They've been around since the late 90s. I remember getting the Pearl one back then. And they have a couple things in common. One, exceptionally well-written, easy to learn from tomes. And two, they usually have a cool line art animal of some sort on the cover.
Yes. The spiky fish that I got was in color.
Ah. And what was your book?
The Uncertain Web. So I had continued to write books, same agent. I'd written beginning HTML and CSS, which is like basically an entry-level textbook for what it says, although there's an entire JavaScript section, which they took out of the title, which I think was a mistake. But anyway, I had written that. It was John Duckett's series previously, and he, like, you know, had sold 100,000 copies of that. I was like, oh, that's great. I'll take on this series. And then he ended up doing a parallel series at the same time, which is literally the most popular technology book of the last 10 years. So I didn't quite do as well as him, but it did well, and it was a great challenge because it's literally every HTML element, every CSS property I had to like understand and write about at least vaguely coherently, right? So it taught me everything. And so it was another example of like, oh, this guy can actually produce books. And so I was just chatting and I said, you know, I have this idea. It's pretty esoteric. I don't know who would publish it. What do you think? And at this time, this is the kind of the height of adoption of HTML5. It was like really everything is going full bore into web development. And a lot of people were taking shortcuts there, including people that shouldn't have been. And it was about the way that I had been architecting on the web for a while, which was to like, don't assume anything about your audience. And if you do that in an intelligent way, you're going to present the best possible experience to the widest number of people. And there's very specific ways that I did that. And then there's some philosophical ways that I did that. And so that was the idea. It was like, the web is a very uncertain place. Anybody that read that book would have been surprised by some of the statistics I shared or some of the common patterns that they were using that I showed, you know, could fail easily, right? This is the idea. And I pitched it and she's like, oh, it's O'Reilly. If we're going to do it, it's O'Reilly. And she put me in touch with Simon St. Laurent there, had a pitch meeting with him. I was on my way to Arizona. I was in the Denver airport, probably a little oxygen starved, but I got the book through that half an hour pitch meeting sitting at the lounge in Denver International Airport.
So you return to the financial services world at Eaton Vance after this?
Yeah. So independent consulting, I never really wanted to build it out to be anything more than just me. And so one of the ways that you do that is you still talk to recruiters and you take corp to corp and you do whatever, right? Because it's all money. And if the jobs are good, why not do it, right? And so I was like, constantly talking to people and have, you know, people that I've known for 15 years that I continued to talk to throughout that. And so I got an opportunity to go work at Eaton Vance as a consultant, and Carl Yastrzemski worked there. all right, this is fine. And it was Angular 2 project, which was great. It was just like, just had been released. And I was really interested in working in TypeScript. And so I interviewed and did like, you know, whiteboard coding sessions and really liked the team and went on board as a consultant. Really, really interesting set of challenges right out of the gate, because it was like, how do you do a full-fledged Angular application? I don't know. You know, let's figure it out. And then, you know, we're not really using Git right. We could be doing it this way. What do you think? Oh, let's try that. And so it was a lot of that sort of thing, just trying to like turn this Skunk Works thing that they had been doing into a real project. And using all that experience I had, like with some of those processes, and being like, yeah, you know this, you know, like we can do this in the front end too. So
you also transitioned to being more hands-off keyboard and kind of directing folks to be able to build that sort of stuff.
Yeah, it's interesting because that was, you know, obviously at Sapient, I didn't code. It just was in meetings and coaching people and just in doing like a kind of high level thoughts about how we were going to do some of that work and interviewing people at like 6-5 in the morning with like the sun coming up behind my back because they're in India. It's like, okay. Yeah. So, you know, obviously that had been my thing. And then I just went into this series of gigs where I was doing sometimes very complicated front-end development, sometimes like really just pushing the envelope again. And then suddenly, like I get into Eaton Vance and the need was just different. It was like, okay, well, we're going to get you some help, Rob. Okay, great. Hey, can you be the Scrum Master? Okay, fine. Like, oh, you know, you're going to manage this whole team from Argentina. Okay. And so it was just natural to just be like, okay, well, I'm going to run the project. I'm going to remove impediments. I'm going to do all, like a lot of the DevOps type coding. So like setting up GitHub to work in very specific ways. And in fact, I mean, at this point, like I'm actually probably more cutting edge at like GitHub than I in Git. Like I spend a lot of time doing that stuff than like pure front-end engineering, actually, which is kind of a byproduct of that and the open source work. So
yeah, you have two very famous repos that you're responsible for, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So two 50,000 plus star repos. So HTML5 boilerplate and front-end developer interview questions, both under the HTML5 BP organization, which I'm the owner of. So, you know, I have to do a lot of plumbing for that. You know, I talk about it. I'm like, yeah, you know, people like would interview me like, oh, can you show me anything you've done? It's like, well, I run this project with 50,000 stars and like 5,000 people watching everything I do. It's like, just watch, see if I'm mature coding, right? I don't actually say that, but that's what runs through my mind sometimes. But yeah, I mean, they're both pretty big, really interesting to have worked on for as long as I've especially HTML5 boilerplate. I've been around for 13 years.
So we mentioned way back in the beginning that you are also an artist. We'll get to you being hands-on, but first, how did you come up with the idea for Art Walks Boston?
My wife and I went to Rome in 2007. I said, oh, you know, we kind of looked in the guidebooks and said, well, if you're going to get the best experience out of the Sistine Chapel, some people were saying you should just go with a tour guide. They also can kind of cut through the complexity of navigating it. which now like is fine. I could do it for people, but like it's the first time in Rome. Okay, sounds good. So we've got this guy, Scott McFiggin. He's still a tour guide in Italy, although he'll take like a group, a family around Sicily, drive them around and show them all of Sicily with his wife. They live in a cave in Tuscany. It's okay. A nice cave, trust me. But yeah, like in the Tuscan Hills. I was like, Scott, really? So he's an expat American living in Rome at the time. And he took us on this tour of the Vatican. And it was just like, he was really appreciative of how much it meant to us to see it with him, because he really knew it very well. And we knew what to expect. Like, we knew it well, but we'd never been there. So he was able to kind of unlock it for us. And I'm still friendly with him. And so, like, I always remembered that. And I wanted to replicate that kind of as a side gig here in Boston. And so this, I started Art Walks Boston because of that.
Now let's talk hands-on artist.
Yeah.
Now, ever since like the 80s, you were a fan of graffiti and decided to become a scribe yourself?
Yeah. So there's a documentary called Style Wars that was on PBS in 1983 and 1984. And I haven't been able to pinpoint which viewing of it I actually saw, because, you know, it's not, the internet wasn't around then to look at the old TV listings or whatever. But I saw that and was immediately hooked. And I was like, I have to figure out how to do this. And it's just problematic for a 12-year-old, but, you know, I did my best.
Can you even buy spray cans at 12?
Yeah, no, probably not. I don't know. It's a long time ago. But yeah, so from that point on, I was, yeah, a fan and a practitioner and have kept at it in one way or another ever since.
You have an Instagram that has some of your work, right?
Yeah, so Rob React, rob.react. Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting kind of subculture. Some of my oldest friends are people that I was writing with in the 80s and 90s, and we still see each other. It's like some people go play golf. We go to like some
blank wall.
Some blank wall. Well, we have a couple, right? So like there are several legal walls in Stoneham and right outside of Providence. And there's a couple of places that we do meet for, you know, there's legal walls, usually along like a rail trail. So you have like people like riding their bikes by. Hopefully they don't run into you. And then there's a couple of walls that we've secured, you know, where you like kind of talk to the business owner and you say, hey, we're going to paint. And they're like, oh, that's great. You know, keep the ugly graffiti off and, you know, you guys can come. So instead of, you know, a golf weekend or whatever, hunting weekend, we go hang out in a parking lot.
Now, what is I Am Okay If Mother Only Knew?
It's a crew. So you can think of a graffiti crew as like a gang, but not like a gang. I mean, it's like, it's the analogy that most people reach for. It's a group of like-minded individuals that come together under an organization, basically. And If Mother Only Knew I'm Okay was founded in 1989 in New York and has been an ongoing concern since.
Now, you've also been into comic book collecting, especially with some focus on the more expensive collectibles.
I've been collecting comics for basically as long as I can remember. And I was like a comic dealer when I was like 13. I would like drive around and do shows and stuff like that. In the last 20 years, I've done a lot of original research, including like talking to folks that are no longer with us about their experiences with the most valuable comics in the hobby. And so like the idea there was to not say like, oh, Action One, generic Action One is the most valuable comic book. It was to actually identify the individual objects owned by named or unnamed individual people and like what those would sell for, which is a whole nother level of detective work and knowledge gathering. So it took a long time.
Was Action Comics number one? Is that Superman?
First appearance of Superman, first superhero.
Very cool. Rob, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your experiences with the listeners of Underserved.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been really, really great.
And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.